and lift up the voices of those who are often silenced, close quote. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 71 degrees and sunny. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Hey, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker.
We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Chris Garlock.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
On today's show, the 65th Annual Academy Awards, the Oscars, were held last Sunday. Today, we bring you the first ever Labor Oscars from our friends at the Power of Work podcast.
We really wanted to highlight the way that labor has been portrayed in the movies, whether that's good or bad, and lift up some of these films that have real potential for ideological and political change and can be really influential and have been really influential when you look back at the history of some of these films.
Norma, you've got the biggest mouth in this mill. Give us a longer break. Give us more smoking time.
Do it. Now shut up.
If I get shot, they can't shoot the union out of me.
And on the latest cool things from the Meaning Labor Archives. And some of you may remember that the George Meaning Labor Archives used to be housed at the National Labor College where I worked. Now it's digitized. And the civil rights records, including documents from films and photographs from the AFL-CIO Civil Rights Department, are now available online through Advancing Workers' Rights in the American South, a three-year project between the University of Maryland and Georgia State University.
Elise, a symposium exploring the rich history of the intersection of the civil rights and labor movements is going to be held in early April, and archivists Ben Blake and Alan Weirdeck will be sharing highlights from the new collection.
Today, they bring us clips from For Fair Play, a 1955 short film dramatizing the story of how the process of integrating a school and a manufacturing plant positively impacted a local community.
He said it wasn't only Negroes having a rough time getting a job, it was rough for Catholics, Poles, Hungarians, Jews, Italians, lots of people. I said, we have hands, don't we, and feelings. I've got a family. Parents eat something, don't they? I want to do work I know, and you keep telling me no job, no job. It's not fair.
Let's start off the show with another in our favorite labor song series from our very own Elise Bryant.
It's one of the few songs, classic labor songs, written by a person of African-American descent.
Hi, this is Michael Funke from the Radical Songbook on PirateButteRadio.com. I'm proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with over 200 radio shows and podcasts across the country and around the world. Tune in, LaborRadioNetwork.org. Power to the workers and their union.
You might remember that Elise's first choice for favorite labor song a few weeks back was Rockin' Solidarity Forever. Here's another on Elise's top 10 favorite labor songs.
It's got to be Roll the Union On. And this version is by the Almanac Singers. And Pete Seeger, who used to come to the Great Labor Arts Exchange, loved John Hancock's. And their version of the song is really rocking it.
We're gonna roll.
My contradiction is a bunch of white people singing the song. Well, it's one of the few songs, classic labor songs, written by a person of African-American descent. And I don't remember which arts exchange it was, but it was fairly early on when I started coming to the arts exchange that John Hancock's came. And John Hancock's was a sharecropper farmer organizer with the Tenant Farm Workers Union. And he had written this song years ago and was accredited to somebody else who worked at the Smithsonian. As opposed to him. But there he was. I think he was 85 years old when he first came, and he sang this song, and it's just like, it's there. It's just labor classic song.
We're gonna roll, we're gonna roll the union on. We're gonna roll, we're gonna roll, We're gonna roll the Union on. If the banker's in the way, we're gonna roll it over them. Gonna roll it over them. Gonna roll it over them. If the banker's in the way, we're gonna roll it over them. Roll the Union on. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll the Union on. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll the Union on. If Peter's in the way, we're gonna roll it over him. Gonna roll it over him. Gonna roll it over him. If the Peter's in the way, we're gonna roll it over him. Gonna roll the Union on. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll the Union on. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll. We're gonna roll the Union on. If Governor Fuchs in the way, we're gonna roll it over him. Gonna roll it over him. Gonna roll it over him. Governor Fuchs in the way, we're gonna roll it over him. Gonna roll the Union on.
You got the biggest mouth in this mill. Give us a longer break. Give us more smoking time.
Do it. Now shut up.
If I get shot, they can't shoot the Union out of me.
Mastroianni is masterly. It's a beautiful film. You owe it to yourself to see it.
Once social change begins, it can't be reversed. You can't humiliate someone who has pride. And you can't oppress someone who's not afraid anymore.
I'm gonna do what I gotta do, get the Union back!
What I realized putting together this list is that there are just so many movies out there. And you almost get that feeling where it's like, I'm never going to be able to see all of these because there's just so many great ones to watch.
That's Joseph Brandt from the Power at Work podcast. They just released the winners of their Labor Oscars, many of which are classics of the genre, some going back decades. Joseph Brandt, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So the Power at Work blog and podcast launched the Labor Oscars 2024 contest this year. What is that and why did you decide to tackle this?
Yeah, so this was a new project that we were really excited to kick off this year. We really wanted to highlight the way that labor has been portrayed in the movies, whether that's good or bad, and lift up some of these films that have real potential for ideological and political change and can be really influential and have been really influential when you look back at the history of some of these films. So we wanted to take the award season film buzz and give it a little labor spin. But we also just wanted to have fun with it. You know, we do a lot of serious talking over at the Power at Work blog, so it's fun to have a bit of a change of pace and offer something a little different for our subscribers. And the idea really came along. It started as a list of movies that were connected to worker power and unions, and we put it up on the blog to kind of gauge interest. And it very quickly became the most viewed post on the Power at Work blog. So I guess our audience is full of film fans and cinephiles, but we were very happy to have them and to kind of develop this into a bigger project where people could give their input, talk about their favorite movies, their least favorite movies, and we had a really good time engaging with our audience in that way. And I hope, as everyone will see if they watch the Labor Oscars blogcast, we had a great time doing the awards ceremony with Andrea Lyman, the New England local president of SAG-AFTRA, Harold Phillips, who is a friend of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, and I'm sure very familiar to the listeners of this show, and Jennifer Marin, who is the Alliance of Women Film Journalists president and co-founder. So we had a really great time, and I hope everyone else enjoys it as much as we did.
Well, having directed the DC Labor Film Fest for over 20 years, I can tell you, Joseph, people really do appreciate the chance to take a break from the very serious work of fighting for labor rights and walking picket lines and going to rallies and, you know, go check out a movie and have some popcorn and hang out with your friends. So really glad to have you guys on board and leading on this. Now, you guys set up five categories, best feature film, best documentary film, best international labor film, best worker power profile, easy for me to say. And I have to say, this might be my favorite category, Joseph, worst movie about unions. I can't wait to hear about that. But you went ahead and you did select five nominees in each category. There's a full list of 55 labor movies, and I recommend folks going to the blog and checking that out. But let's cut to the chase, have the envelope, as they say, and talk about the winners. And I think we'll just, why don't we take it from the top, best feature film. Why don't you just quickly review who the nominees were?
For best feature film, we had On the Waterfront, Norma Rae, Madawan, Bread and Roses, and Rustin from this year. Our winner, somewhat unsurprisingly, because this is one of the most loved labor films of all time, was Norma Rae from 1979.
20th Century Fox presents Norma Rae.
Norma, you got the biggest mouth in this mill. Give us a longer break. Give us more smoking time.
Do it. Now shut up.
This is the story of a woman with the courage to risk everything for what she knows is right.
Lady, I want you off the premises now.
I started this, and I'm going to finish it.
I want you out of here right quick.
Norma Rae.
I think one of the main takeaways was that one image of Norma Rae standing up there with the union sign and standing on the table, how influential and impactful that was to so many people, that it's such an actionable, seemingly easy thing to do, but we see how much courage and work that something like that takes. So I think that a lot of people feel really seen by Norma Rae and how real and normal that she feels and how accessible of a character she is.
Good call. All right, moving on. Best documentary film. And I'll tell you a funny story on that. I think it was the second year of the DC Labor Film Fest. I think we showed all documentaries and they were all good. But I remember people were coming out and they're like, God, Chris, you know, these are great, but, you know, can't you give us something a little less serious? I learned a lesson that year was, you know, you got to give people a little roses with the bread, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and that's something we tried to keep in mind when we were pulling together this list, is that we want to have all of the very serious, you know, documentaries and very important films that are about more conflicting times, but we also, it's a list of 55, so it can't be a list of 55 depressing kind of downtrodden films. So I will say it was a bit of a struggle, because I think that that labor organizers, and I guess the people who make the movies about labor organizers, tend to focus on the conflict of things. But there are definitely some ones in there that are a little more lighthearted.
Got it. All right. So give us the five nominees, if you would.
Sure. The five nominees were Harlan County, USA, 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement, American Dream, one of two on this list, directed by Barbara Kopple, The Hand That Feeds, and The Wobblies.
Good list. Good, tough list. I'm trying to think of who. Let me just do a guess here. Put myself out on a limb. I'm going to go with Harlan County. Barbara Kopple, I think our fifth year at the festival, we gave her our award. Wonderful director, just terrific. I don't know who won. I'm on the edge of my seat here.
I'm happy to tell you that you're correct, Chris.
Harlan, Kentucky is coal country, where men work long hours for short wages, where poverty, black lung, and needless disaster are facts of life. In 1973, the men voted to join the United Mine Workers Union. The company refused to sign the contract, and so began the Battle of Harlan County, USA.
Which side are you on?
Without organization, you are a lone individual. Without influence and without recognition of any kind.
They're treating us like that We're animals, dogs. Well, we aren't. We're American citizens.
All of our life, we've been kicked around. We've been put in jail. We've been shot at. We've had dynamite thrown at us. And then you don't want us to have nothing. Well, I tell you, Mr. Horn, I'm going to be standing right there on that picket line looking at you just as long as it takes.
If I get shot, they can't shoot the Union out of me.
It's powerful, provocative, exciting, and frightening because it's real. Harlan County, USA.
The judges each had a pretty personal connection to this documentary and remembered seeing it and really feeling the spirit of it and feeling so moved by it. And I think that that is something that is not lost at all today. I mean, when you watch the movie, it's the same feelings, the same frustrations that we're still dealing with today. So I think that it is a testament to documentary filmmaking and how you can make something that feels so moving and powerful and really impactful.
Best International Labor Film. Tell us what the nominees were.
The Organizer from Italy, The Factory from India, Made in Dagenham from the UK, The Land from Egypt, and Germinal from France.
Wow, that I don't know how you got it down to five. I'm you guys are tough.
It was tough. It's so hard to compare them because they're each so important, it feels like, and it all feels like these stories are so unique and almost unheard. This was an exciting category along with the documentaries, but international, I would say, was probably one of the harder ones to narrow down.
I'm gonna make a guess here, and it's really just a personal favorite of mine, although, you know, again, all five of them are excellent choices. I really loved Made in Dagenham. When we first showed it, it was not well known in this country. And it's just an incredibly well-made film. And, you know, I think, as you pointed out earlier, a lot of labor films don't end well. This one is the rare story and film that actually has a win. But who was the winner?
The winner was The Organizer from Italy.
Once in a great while, a motion picture with the mark of greatness on it comes along to win the thunderous acclaim of press and public alike. Such a picture is The Organizer. Market must see, said the New York Herald Tribune. One of the best movies of this and many a year. Mastroianni is masterly. It's a beautiful film. You owe it to yourself to see it.
Classic. You should tell folks a little bit about that because people may or may not know about it.
Yeah, so The Organizer is a movie from 1963 that was, I would say, very ahead of its time. It's one of the earlier sort of modern takes on a film that we have that features a labor organizer, and it features Marcello Mastroianni really in a powerhouse of a role, just living up to the title. And I really don't want to give too much away because this one is fun to watch kind of unravel, but it's definitely worth checking out. It's one that's a little harder to find, I'd say, but it's a classic for a reason, and I think it still resonates with audiences, even though it's a foreign film from 1963.
All right. Best Worker Power Profile. This is not a category you see at the Academy Awards. So
no, it's not.
How did you come up with it? And what was the concept there?
Well, the original idea for this category actually came from the Weekly Download, which is something that we do at the Power at Work blog, where we curate news clippings and articles, press releases, and all kinds of things from across the internet, and we sort them into a couple of categories that we have. And one of those categories is Worker Power Profile, which is a more in-depth look at an individual union member, organizer, leader, and the work that they do. So we wanted to expand that to this movie's idea, because there are a lot of union and labor biopics out there, but there are also a lot of great documentaries that are focused on individual people that are focused on small groups. So we wanted to put those two types of films sort of in conversation with one another. And I think that this came out as a really fun category because it's a great group of films. And I think that they all fit well together.
I'm just looking at the list here, and it is, I mean, all of them, your whole big list, but also then your shorter, you know, list of nominees. This is a really solid list, and I'm just trying to figure out who might have won. But go ahead and tell us who the nominees were.
The nominees were Cesar Chavez, Union Maids, 10,000 Black Men Named George, Brothers on the Line, and Rustin.
I mean, I got to be honest, you could just show all five of those back to back and have a fabulous evening, don't you think?
Yes, I agree. I think that would be a great time.
Oh, man, you would just come out feeling so wonderful. All right, I don't know. I'm just trying to think of who could. I mean, I love all of them. I'm a big fan, particularly of Rustin, partly because it's brand new and it's a story that so few people know.
Mm-hmm.
10,000 Black Men Named George is another one I often recommend to folks. Gosh, maybe Union Maids, which is another classic. I don't know. I'm at a loss, dude. You're going to help me out. Who won? I'm just, again, on the edge of my seat.
Our winner in this category was Cesar Chavez from 2014.
I come here out of respect for one of the heroic figures of our time, Cesar Chavez.
To be successful, we have to have an army of boycotters willing to do the hard work. The bigger the army, the bigger the success.
Farm workers in Delano, California, have begun an unprecedented strike in the Central Valley.
They've been coming in bigger numbers ever since Chavez quit eating. How long can a man go without food?
It depends on the man, John. Everything depends on the man.
Once social change begins, it can't be reversed. You can't humiliate someone who has pride. And you can't oppress someone who's not afraid anymore.
So this is a biopic about Cesar Chavez. And I think it's a little interesting in terms of a biopic because it's not the type of movie that follows him from the time he was a teenager to him finding himself. You're dropped kind of in the middle of things where he's already a very well-established organizer. It gives you a little bit of context about who he is, but it really lets the action speak for itself. And I think that that resonates a lot with audiences because this movie doesn't paint Cesar Chavez as a saint or this sort of untouchable, amazing person that's not saying that he wasn't, but you know what I mean. It's not too heavy on the idolization, which is something you want to be cautious with biopics. And it makes Cesar Chavez a very relatable, real character that you're able to follow. And I will say that this movie gives a beautiful blend of strategy and then kind of the on-the-boots organizing, because I think a lot of these films are either one or the other. You have labor organizers on the ground, picketing, interacting with employers, or you have a movie about executives or union leaders sitting at a bargaining table or a courtroom or something like that. And I think you kind of get both of those flavors with Cesar Chavez, which makes it unique for this list, but also just a really, I'd say, informative watch because you see kind of how these decisions are made, what they're thinking through, and you get to learn a little bit more about the farm workers' struggle, which I think especially for people of my generation, we definitely need to know about because it connects directly to the same issues that are going on in Florida and parts of Southern California now.
All right, so brings us to your fifth and final category, worst movie about unions. Certainly those of us that have been programming labor films for years are well aware of this category. I don't know that I ever actually thought of it as a category, so thank you for that. But if you can talk a little bit about how you came up with this, what was the thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, this, like you said, is not a category you're going to see at the Oscars. So we went off the beaten path there a little bit, but we really just wanted to have fun with this one and also acknowledge the fact that on our list of 55, they're not all gems. But I think that that partially points to the fact that we don't have enough movies about labor, at least in the United States, and that that's a concerted effort on Hollywood Studios' part to not give these people voices and not give these stories voices and resonance and not let audiences connect with these types of people. So go out there and see movies like Rustin and other movies about labor and organizing and civil rights and all of those things. Go support them in the theater and put money in the box offices, because that's how those films are going to keep getting made, unfortunately. And the fact that we have so little to choose from in terms of really great, good movies that we can say here are 55 of the best labor movies of all time. I hope we get to that place one day, but I think that until then, it's fun to talk about bad labor movies like this. So you have a lot of labor movies that are either A, just a bad movie, they're slow moving, not entertaining, poorly produced, poorly written. B, romanticize certain aspects of labor organizing. In the case of The Pajama Game, quite literally, where a union organizer falls in love with the employer, and at the end, he suddenly has a change of heart, as you could see coming. But I think also C, there's movies that just really brutalize labor in terms of its portrayal of labor and violence, which I think is an important aspect to some of these stories, but I think some films, it gets a little gratuitous and it feels more about a movie about corruption and political violence than it does a movie about worker power or unions or collective action. So I think that this category is a good way to kind of bring that conversation together in a bit of a more fun way.
So much to talk about. You could do a whole show just talking about these. Why don't you go ahead and just, if you can share with folks the five that made the final cut.
The five are Boxcar Bertha from 1972, Inside Detroit from 1956, The Pajama Game from 1957, Fist from 1978, and Hoffa, 1992. The people that we had on the blogcast, our judges and our audience, are all labor-focused people, so that's obviously the perspective that they're going to come from, but that's not the only value that these movies have. Jennifer Marin, who is the president of the Alliance of Women Film Journalists, spoke very eloquently about the task that labor organizers and people who care about labor have of sort of monitoring the way that labor is portrayed. Because Hollywood studios aren't too friendly to labor unions. So I think it's an important thing to balance of just being a normal movie enjoyer, but also having that kind of watchful, critical eye of, well, now why are they portraying them that way? Or why is this person so violent or aggressive or put in this position or things like that? So I think it's an interesting conversation to have.
Drum roll, please. The envelope, who is the winner? Let me see if I can guess here. Maybe Hoffa? I'm not sure. You spare me the suspense. Hit me with it.
You're correct on another one, Chris. It was Hoffa.
20th Century Fox proudly presents a Danny DeVito film.
Brothers, we are going to march. We are going to hold together. We are going to get what we came down here for.
He was capable of anything.
All I'm saying is there's a lot more there for us. It's right, it's just, it's do us, and it's possible.
He wasn't afraid of anyone.
He said, why should we take you out in the alley and beat you until you beg for death?
Tell him he gives me a cup of coffee, I'll answer his questions.
That's why everyone was afraid of him.
The Justice Department has plenty on you, Mr. Hoffa.
You don't impress me.
He didn't want law, he wanted justice.
I'm gonna do what I gotta do, get the union back.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I'm gonna do what I gotta do.
It's just not a great film. It's a little boring somehow while still trying to be action-packed, and it doesn't move at the right pace. It's a little, I don't really know the right word, but it just didn't excite. And I think the fact that there are so many issues politically and historically with the way that it portrayed Jimmy Hoffa and the way that it glamorized violence and corruption in unions, which became more about corrupt power and people abusing power than it did really being about the union. I think that didn't resonate with audiences.
Hey, listen, before we wrap up, just a couple of quick sort of questions. You yourself are, as you mentioned, you're a younger person yourself. And for me, as somebody who's been going to films since I was quite young, when films were actually not available 24/7 and you could watch them on your phone, it's very exciting to me to see folks who appreciate and are interested in film, right? I just wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your own relationship to film, but also maybe the things that you've learned or observations in going through this particular contest and putting it together and the work that you've done on it.
I've just loved going to the movies forever. It's always been a way for me to connect with my family and kind of engage in conversation with them. And same thing with my friends. It's probably one of the things we do most commonly is just find something on a streaming service to put on. And whether we talk through it or talk about it, it's always a great time. And I think it's a really interesting entry point for a lot of conversations like these, where you can have your hand in 30 different pies, but still be having a coherent conversation about film. So I find it very exciting and stimulating to search things out and create lists of things I'd like to watch, lists of things I've seen. I think more generally in terms of what I realized putting together this list is that there are just so many movies out there, and you almost get that feeling where it's like, I'm never going to be able to see all of these because there's just so many great ones to watch.
Welcome to my world, brother. Welcome to my world.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's, I mean, 55 is a place to start for sure. But I encourage everyone to find a movie you like on there and seek out others like it, to look into the directors that were featured, the movies that they've made. I think that part of the joy of doing something like this is getting the opportunity to, you know, sift through titles and directors and things that I definitely have never heard of. And I think that people who either aren't into labor or aren't into film or vice versa, that there's so much crossover here just on this list of the ways that these conversations intersect and these movements intersect. I mean, we saw what happened in Hollywood or all over the country, really, with the actors and writers strike. So I think that it's important for people to do the work of going back and looking back at what was important, what was influential, what inspired people, what moved people, because we also have, like you said, access to every movie at our fingertips. So that comes with a ton of privilege of getting to explore and select and do all of those things. But it's also very easy for films like The Land from 1970 from Egypt to get kind of lost in the murk. So I think that the more people we have doing things like this, talking about labor film, talking about any kind of film, the more support that we give to the creators, the industry, and like you said, the workers.
Joseph Prant, thanks so much. Congratulations to you and the entire Power at Work blog and podcast crew for Labor Oscars 2024. It's a great contest, really exciting, and just a wonderful addition to everything that's been going on with Labor Films. And just a big congratulations to you all.
Thanks so much, Chris. We really appreciate it and all the support we get from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. It's been great working with everybody. And I just want to say to our audience, please go check out our awards ceremony to hear a little bit more about these films, hear from our judges on which films they pick, their predictions. And we are hoping to do events like this in the future. So whether it's with movies, whether it's with other kinds of media, we are excited about how well this went and looking to do more like it. So go to the front page of the Power at Work blog and subscribe, and you will not miss any of our future events, surveys, content, anything. So thanks again for having me, Chris. It's been great.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1906. This is the day the world lost a great champion of women's and workers' rights. Susan B. Anthony. Born in 1820 in Massachusetts to a Quaker family, Susan is most well known for her tireless campaign to secure the right to vote for women. But did you know she was also a staunch supporter of women's rights in the workplace? She experienced the unequal treatment of women in the workplace firsthand. In 1848, Anthony was a teacher in New York, where she discovered that male teachers earned $10 a month to teach, while women only earned $2.50. Anthony became involved in the teachers' union, continually advocating for equal pay and advancing the call for the 8-hour workday. She encouraged women, excluded from participation in the labor movement by men, to form their own labor organizations. And in 1870, she helped to found the Working Women's Central Association. Anthony was often rebuffed and ignored by men in her effort to give women a greater voice in the labor movement. In 1869, she took a controversial stand during a strike of union printers in New York. During the strike, she encouraged women to participate in training programs to teach them the printing trade during the strike. She believed that this would prove that women could do the job as well as men. Because of her stance, many within labor labeled her as a strikebreaker. In the decades that followed, Anthony continued to build relationships within labor and encouraged women to participate in trade unionism. One of Susan B. Anthony's most often repeated quotes was, "Join the union, girls, and together say equal pay for equal work." A call to action that resonates today. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
This is Elise Bryant putting on my union hat as president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. All women deserve equal pay for equal work. Earlier this week, we marked Equal Pay Day. Note that I don't say celebrated Equal Pay Day, because it's not the day that women achieved equal pay. It marks how far into the year, March 12th this year, women must work to earn what men earned the previous year. Equal Pay Day serves as a painful reminder of the ongoing gender gap that exists. To underline the point, we pulled together a couple of sound clips from the archives, one from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and the other from a 1966 public service announcement. The clips may sound dated, but the wage gap is still with us.
A ticking bomb means trouble for Batman and Robin.
Holy breaking and entering! It's Batgirl!
Quick, Batgirl, untie us before it's too late.
It's already too late. I've worked for you a long time, and I'm paid less than Robin. Same job, same employer means equal pay for men and women.
No time for jokes, Batgirl.
It's no joke. It's the federal equal pay law.
Holy act of Congress!
If you're not getting equal pay, contact the Wage and Hour Division, U.S. Department of Labor.
What?
I'm upset, and you're just ignoring it.
Well, I figured it was just one of those woman things.
No, Mr. Grant, it's not one of those woman things. I would like to know why the last associate producer before me made $50 a week more than I do.
Oh, because he was a man.
Let me get this straight. The only reason he was paid more than I am is because he was a man?
Oh, sure. It has nothing to do with your work.
Wait, no. Wait a minute. You know, because I want to understand this. I'm doing as good a job as he did.
Better.
And I'm being paid less than he was because...
You're a woman.
Well, Mr. Grant, there is no good reason why two people doing the same job at the same place shouldn't be making the same...
He had a family to support. You don't. Now, why don't you come back when you have an answer to that?
Because financial need has nothing to do with it. Because in order to be consistent with what you're saying, you would have to pay the man with three children more than the man with two children, and the married man more than the bachelor. And Mr. Grant, you don't do that. So what possible reason can you give me for not paying me at least as much as the man who had this job before me?
Say, Lou.
Yes, Ted.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were busy.
Oh, we're not. Come on in, Ted.
By the way, women in unions earn 22% more than non-union women. For women of color, the wage gap is essentially closed when they have a union contract. I'm just saying.
You're listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. Revolutionary radio for revolutionary times.
All right, welcome back to Cool Things from the Mini Labor Archives. Ben Blake and Alan Weirdeck. And understand we've got a film to talk about today. Ben Blake, why don't you kick things off for us?
Today's film that we're highlighting is called For Fair Play. And it was produced in 1955 by the Pennsylvania State Commission on Industrial Race Relations. So it's happening right as the civil rights movement is gaining huge momentum around the Brown versus Board of Education decision a year earlier. And it's the same year that the AFL and CIO were merging. So it's a critical juncture in history. The film itself is a fictionalized account of a machinist being able to overcome discrimination in a probably looks like a steel mill or fabricating plant. And it really puts you in the mainstream of that time in the mid-50s.
It wasn't only Negroes having a rough time getting a job. It was rough for Catholics, Poles, Hungarians, Jews, Italians, lots of people. I said, we have hands, don't we, and feelings. I've got a family. They're and eat something, don't they? I want to do work I know, and you keep telling me no job, no job. It's not fair.
But I think what's interesting in terms of putting the film into context, as it turns out, and I didn't know this until I did a little research, Pennsylvania was a leader in kind of the fight to establish or ban discrimination in employment. And this kind of battle went back to 1938, where it was led by the NAACP and the Urban League. Specific provisions would ban discrimination in unions. And that's why the statewide federations at that time opposed it. And then fast forward to 1945, there's a new effort to establish a Federal Employment Practices Committee or Commission, which is modeled after the national one. And by 45, the effort to establish a national commission basically had floundered. The Roosevelt administration and Truman pretty much killed it. And this commission would have powers of enforcement against discrimination in employment. So Pennsylvania decided to go ahead on their own and develop a Fair Employment Practices Commission that would really enforce anti-discrimination laws. And it really didn't get going until 1952, when the commission on industrial relations was founded. And its first task was to survey Pennsylvania industry to find out, to document discrimination. And they found widespread discrimination. And the reasons for discrimination that they identified, the top three were tradition, employers, and then unions. So there was a significant problem within the labor movement. And they also found that across the board, two-thirds of Pennsylvania employers discriminated in terms of skilled trades. And the film is based on an African-American machinist finally getting a job. So he's a skilled worker. Obviously, the commission was targeting what they thought was one of the most important areas to fight against discrimination.
Douglas, the hiring boss, talked it over with department heads, not just about Parker, but about the whole idea. He wasn't doing any better than I did. That kind of hiring would make trouble. There'd be a million rough spots. But Douglas had facts. More work got done and fewer guys quit in plants with fair employment policies than in other places. Segregation was ending in the armed forces and in the schools. Some states had fair employment laws, and in our state, many plants hire workers for the job, not who they are. And he got a slow okay.
So this film would have been used how at the time?
It was an educational film. I think basically it really centers more around the white worker who becomes an ally of the African American. So it's definitely aimed at white industrial workers, and in particular, the issue of discontinuing the discrimination against African Americans into the skilled trades.
And I found this article from the Philadelphia Tribune, April 9th, 1957. So 2 years after this film was produced, and it's just a quote from Clarence E. Pickett, who's the chairman of the Philadelphia Fellowship Commission for the Hotel and Restaurant Employees and Bartenders International Union. And he says, quote, "Our support of the NAACP and other Negro organizations in their struggle for fair play is well known. And we have always encouraged our local unions, joint executive boards, and state councils at all times to further programs to end segregation in their areas or communities." I think what this film highlights is a broader, longstanding effort of integration in the workplace.
That Sunday, as I listened to the pastor, I began to realize what I had started when, in his sermon,
"My friends, brotherhood means exactly and no less that all men are brothers. Every human being is a child of God. All are equal in his sight. Not just you and you and you, but all others, be they French, Chinese, or Africans, be they Mohammedans, Jews, or Catholics. All human beings everywhere in the whole world, and in your neighborhood as well, are equal in his sight and are his children."
He really let us have it.
"If you believe in brotherhood on Sunday and deny it the rest of the week, you are not God-fearing men."
He talked about the situation at the plant and asked a question.
"By what right does any one of you take it on yourself to deny another man the chance to work, the chance to live decently, the chance to have a happy family? To discriminate against a fellow human being is to sin against a fellow human being. We can't turn brotherhood off and on like a faucet. We must practice it every minute of our lives. And that means not only in the church, but in our work. Let us pray."
And I guess last question, and maybe I could get you each to take a cut at it, what your thoughts are looking at this 1955 film. What does it have to say to a 2024 audience?
I think that there's this like myth of the white working class, but also there's validity to the white working class. I mean, I think the film itself is quite dated in its appearance and its dramatization. Simultaneously, I think that there are messages and imagery from 1955 that could very easily appear in racially restrictive zoned neighborhoods where schools may be integrated, but there's obviously some layers to that integration. I think that racism as we understand it today has transformed from where it was in 1955, where it was considerably more out in the open. But we still see segregated neighborhoods. We still see segregated workplaces. I think that they're just segregated differently. You know, instead of racially segregated workplaces, we now have the tier system. So I think it's just interesting to see how the bosses divide workers, whether it's 1955 or 2024.
I think what's interesting is the film itself does not even mention unions. And the only organization essentially that actively opposes racism is the church, which is incredible. The other thing I should mention quickly is that in 1955, Pennsylvania passed a Human Relations Act that did ban discrimination by employers and despite the opposition of both state councils, they continued to oppose it. But they were able to pass this, and it was the only or the first example of legislation that established a Fair Employment Practices Commission. Pennsylvania kind of led the way, and it was primarily because the NAACP and the Urban League and the civil rights movement as a whole just put tremendous pressure on the governor and the state. And the unions at the state level kind of stood aside. Four CIO unions and only one AFL union did support the legislation. And the four CIO unions were unions that were alleged in the Cold War to be communist-led. So I thought that's very interesting how general right-wing politics, anti-communism, intertwine with opposition to civil rights.
Slowly, the men got used to Parker. Sure, unpleasant things happened. Some guys don't learn a thing. But when the new wing of the plant went up, all kinds of people got jobs. They are hired for what they can do. Their religion or color don't matter. Now, more money is being spent because more money is being made in our town. It's not just that Parker is living in a better house these days and we're going to be able to pull down those shacks near the railroad. It's not even that there are fewer kids going wrong in town than there used to be. It's that we've got a good feeling in our hearts. We feel more free and I guess contented is the word. We feel we're doing something not only for ourselves, not only for our town and the state, but for America and our future, the future of our children.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. The year was 1912. The Lawrence, Massachusetts textile workers' strike had worn on for over a month. More than 20,000 workers had walked off the job. Most of them were young women. Nearly half of those on strike had been in the United States less than 5 years. Each strike communication had to be translated into as many as 25 languages. As often happened at the turn of the 20th century, violence broke out on the picket lines between strikers and the police, with one protester dying from an errant bullet and another losing her life from being stabbed by a soldier's bayonet. Despite these difficulties, the women stayed true to their call for bread and roses. Supported by the industrial workers of the world, textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts had walked off the job to protest wage reductions. But they were not only striking for bread, they were also demanding respect and dignity and a better quality of life. They wanted bread, yes, but roses too. As the strike wore on, some of the women decided to send their children out of town and away from the growing danger. In what became known as the Children's Exodus, more than 100 children were sent to New York City. Upon arrival in Manhattan, the children were greeted by cheering crowds of thousands of supporters. The Children's Exodus won sympathy for the striking women. In an attempt to stop the news of the strike from spreading, on February 24th, the Lawrence City Marshal decided to stop 46 children from leaving for Philadelphia. Police beat mothers trying to help their children board the train. One woman suffered a miscarriage. Across the nation, people were outraged. Congress launched an investigation into the strike. The bosses had finally gone too far. And on this day in labor history, the striking women finally won most of their demands. And their cry of bread and roses would go on to inspire the labor movement for generations to come. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a note at info@laborheritage.org. Our music today included two versions of Roll the Union On, one by Pete Seeger and the Almanac Singers, and the other by John Hancock, who came to the Great Labor Arts Exchange for many years and who wrote the song.
The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. Today's show is produced by me, Chris Garlock, and engineered by Mike DeSella and Kalia Chapman, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, the art and soul of the American labor movement.
See you next week.
pay gas. Why don't you do the math? Pay gas, pay gas. Ripping my dollars in half. It's not that I'm asking for more than I'm owed, and I don't think I'm better than you. You say that we live in the land of the free, but sometimes that bell don't ring true. It's been that way with no equal pay, and I wanna know when it will be fixed. Women do work and get treated like slaves since 1776.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today's Thursday, March 14th. Here are some headlines. A federal judge is hearing arguments today on whether to dismiss the classified documents prosecution case against former President Trump. The dispute centers on whether the Presidential Records Act gave Trump the authority to designate classified documents as personal and maintain possession of them after his presidency. Special Counsel Jack Smith says the files Trump is charged with possessing are presidential records, not personal ones, and that the statute does not apply to classified and top secret documents like those kept at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. Presumptive GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump is attending today's hearing, though he was not required to do so. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer today called for new elections in Israel, saying Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way. Schumer made the statement in a 40-minute speech from the Senate floor this morning. He said the extreme right-wing bent of Netanyahu's government means, quote, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows, close quote. Schumer, the first Jewish majority leader in the Senate, had positioned himself as an Israeli ally following the October 7 attack by Hamas. But pressure has increased on President Biden and other Democratic leaders to pull back on U.S. support for Israel amid the massive level of death and destruction it has caused in Gaza. In his speech, Schumer also called for the removal of Hamas and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. The next Israeli parliamentary elections aren't scheduled until October 2026. In related news, the Israel Defense Forces said yesterday that it would evacuate a significant number of Palestinian civilians from Gaza's southern city of Rafah to what it calls humanitarian islands in central Gaza. This comes as Israel plans to launch a ground invasion of Rafah. An estimated 1.4 million Palestinians, which is more than half of Gaza's population, are now sheltering in Rafah, which borders Egypt, after fleeing the north and center of the enclave. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a gigantic tragedy should the invasion move ahead. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said it is necessary to advance into Rafah to destroy Hamas's remaining military battalions. Meanwhile, a first boat loaded with 200 tons of food aid is making slow progress toward the Gaza Strip today as efforts grew to bring more humanitarian assistance to the Palestinian territory. Speaking to journalists today, the EU's humanitarian aid and crisis management chief said there are already pockets of famine in Gaza and it could spread to the whole region. He also said airdrops and a maritime corridor will not be enough to make up for supplies transported by trucks into Gaza, and urged Israel to open more road routes to deliver aid. The United Nations estimates that more than 500,000 people in Gaza are on the brink of starvation. UN agencies said earlier this month that child malnutrition levels were particularly extreme in the northern part of the enclave. And in weather today in Washington,